Hello, and welcome back to Aristogenesis. It's been some time since we last uploaded an episode, and there has been very good reason for the delay. As I said at the end of our last episode, I've been away on a religious pilgrimage of sorts in order to further my knowledge, my life in general, and most importantly, my connection to the gods. And having experienced all of this and more, we thought that it would be fitting to talk not only about my most recent experiences and the benefit that similar pilgrimages could have for you, our listeners, but also our collective general experiences in practicing the traditional religions of Europe, why we think it's important, and where to get started for those who are interested or struggling to find a way to actively practice a traditional European faith.
Before we begin, we must, as always, state the disclaimer that the promotion of love for one's own people should not be equated with the hatred of others. There's going to be a lot that we discuss in this episode, and if you're listening to this on our YouTube channel, there are a lot of rules regarding topics and content that we often have to dance around. So if you'd like to hear the whole discussion uncensored, as it were, I suggest you check out our Spreaker channel, also called Aristogenesis. There will be a link to that in the description below. With that out of the way, hello, my name is Tyrus, and this is Aristogenesis Episode 5, Paganism in the Modern Day.
Greetings from me as well. For this episode, we have decided to do things a bit differently. As you may have noticed, we took a short break from our podcast due to Tyrus's absence. And now that he's back, we decided to use this opportunity in order to discuss and explore the subject of modern paganism, the phenomenon of attempting to revive, recreate, and practice pre-Christian Aryan religious traditions. It is a very interesting and controversial subject, which, among other things, has a political dimension, which we will explore further in this episode. The general theme of our podcast is not strictly political, in the way that politics are understood today. Real, traditional politics, however, as understood and practiced in the cultures of our ancestors, were, in their very base, philosophy and ethics, and from this perspective, politics is highly interesting to us. My co-host Tyrus, besides his many other talents, is also a pagan, a follower of a traditional Aryan faith, and he has been doing that quite some time without losing his political and ideological compass. So his pagan practice, combined with his political engagement, his ideological beliefs, and his young age, makes him quite unique. And I thought that doing an interview with you, Tyrus, would make a great foundation for the subject of our episode. So let us begin. Can you start by telling us, where have you been, Tyrus?
I've been at a temple in which I have helped the construction of new altars to the gods, as well as more general sort of building work. Of course, during these months, I've had the opportunity to perform a great many offerings to the gods, all according to the old rites, furthering my own spiritual knowledge and development. And as a result, I have grown closer to the gods. The temple itself has actually recognized me as a sacerdos, a title meaning one who performs sacred acts. So, for all intents and purposes, it's a priest. The priesthood class is something that I feel paganism is fundamentally lacking in the modern day, and the importance of having priests is something I'm sure we're going to discuss later in the episode.
Oh, great. I understand that the pagan tradition you're following is a Roman one, and of that we will speak in details later on. What I actually am most interested in, and I wish to begin with that, is your personal journey. How did you discover paganism, and which are the reasons that led you into practicing it?
My own personal religious journey began sort of not long after my political one, because I realized that both on a personal and on a societal level, for me anyway, life was missing something. The world we're living in is sick. We can see that quite easily. And it became more and more clear to me that the modern world was built on foundations of sand. and it lacked any kind of tradition, religious or otherwise. Everything was commodified and transient, and I realised as a result of this observation that tradition and structure brought meaning to life, and therefore any system, political or otherwise, that rejected tradition was built to fall from the get-go. And the further we strayed from our traditions and spirituality, the fundamentally worse life became for both civilization and those individuals in it. At first, my views were quite secular. I've been raised in a secular environment, and so my logic was to look into the achievements of our ancestors and see what structures shaped their worldviews and experiences of life, what drove them to achieve what they achieved. I thought that even if I couldn't bring myself to wholeheartedly believe in a religion, that religion was still a fundamentally important aspect of my life. And that trying to put myself into the same mindset as my glorious ancestors also required adopting their religion. Of course, once I began reading the works of the philosophers, I found my fundamentally secular worldview, as someone would say, destroyed by facts and logic, in a manner that made me realise that the ancients had a far better grasp of reality than any modern scientist. They look only to explain the how by severing it from the why, if that makes sense. Ultimately, paganism does not conflict with logic and reasoning, but rather enhances it. And the more one learns and practices, the more this Abrahamic veneer of religion being mere faith in the absurd begins to dissipate, and one is able to reconnect with the fundamentally Aryan character of an intellect of reason not severed from spirituality. For me, personally, I could argue that my religious journey began before I can remember, since being a very young child, I adored the Greek myths, as many of us do as children, I suppose, but my adoration went further. My family still have a photo of me on their kitchen wall, dressed as Menelaus of Sparta, when I was around 10 years old, and every week I would rewatch that old film from 1963, I think, Jason and the Argonauts. To this day, one of the only films that does any justice to the depiction of the gods and has any respect for the mythology. It's obviously by no means a perfect film, but it certainly captured my imagination more so than any other as a child. I also remember having a complete revulsion towards Disney's Hercules that I could never quite explain at the time. But I'm certainly glad that my instinctual hatred of that abomination kept me away from it. But, of course, this could all be put down to a childhood interest rather than any sincere religious practice. But I find that what you're pulled towards, even before having a real sense of your own identity, is, or at least can be, of very real spiritual importance. But at the point which I had begun my political awakening, I began to look into ancient religions, groups and cultures that suited my attitudes to life and what I wanted to gain from it. And at the time, Christianity was one of a small selection of things I looked into, solely based on an admiration of the Knights Templar. And being a young teenager getting swept up in the bizarre internet trends of people making crusader memes and that sort of thing, but I quickly realised that this was not a sense of religiosity and spirituality as much as it was a longing for some kind of holy war that the vast majority of these people would be ill-equipped to fight at best. I had a conversation with someone who had never exercised in his life, saying he will be on the front lines as soon as the Pope calls for a new crusade, as if an out-of-shape tradcath raised on a diet of McDonald's and Bible study is going to be of any use against desert-dwelling barbarians who've spent their entire lives firing AKs at their neighbours and shitting up heroin. And that's just those without any form of military training. So, to me, Christianity seemed more modern and more convenient to practice in the modern day, and that's not a good thing. Their internet e-crusading was just embarrassing, and then they would have the audacity to call those practicing the religions of their ancestors, or at least trying to, LARPers. It all seemed so fake and inorganic, and if the answer was as simple as go to church on a Sunday, which many of these modern tradcaths don't even do, then there is no way that the world would be in such a decadent place. The civilization we currently live in was built around an Abrahamic mindset, worldview, and sense of morality, and the world we see now is a product of that, whether the average person is actively practicing a form of Abrahamic religion or not. So for me, the only solution was to return to the roots, to a worldview and mindset that built and strengthened our people, rather than corrupting and subjecting them and their societies. And for that, I would need a truly, uniquely Indo-European religion that encapsulates the mindset of all these all-conquering ancients. Christianity is an ultimately alien religion created by and for a foreign people, later Aryanized and adapted by the Europeans to suit their own purposes, but I wanted the real thing that sprang forth organically from Indo-European blood, the religion that shaped our ancestors into the most fearsome and indomitable force of nature mankind has yet known. And when so-called traditionalist Christians talk about returning to traditional Christianity, they don't actually mean traditional Christianity. They mean medieval Christianity, which was already 1,000 years old and had absorbed many of the old Roman ideas and institutions. Nowhere in the Bible does it talk about bishops and cardinals, and the Pope still calls himself the Pontifex Maximus, one of the highest priestly positions in the old Roman religion. Traditional Christianity is not the Knights Templar and the Teutonic Order. This so-called traditional Christianity is closer time-wise to the modern day than it was to the birth of Christ. So why call it traditional? Traditional Christianity was living in Judea under the Roman boot, being thrown to the lions to entertain the emperor, cheered on by crowds of people who looked down on Christians as the spectacular historian Tacitus says, a class hated for their abominations, following an evil, Judean, hideous and shameful, most mischievous superstition. This is traditional Christianity, not knights and cheap imitation of old Roman institutions, or, God forbid, 1950s consumer culture adverts of desk jobs and barbecues on the weekends, as if that was somehow a world away from what we live now.
Excellent point there, Tyrus, about traditional Christianity. I think that the original Christianity grew out from Talmudic dogmas and Middle Eastern superstitions, and was founded upon Judaic mythology, the Old Testament, and the Apostle Paul's multicultural, plebeian, and anti-aristocratic universalism, the New Testament. I think what these people mean as traditional Christianity is a result of a transformation process where the original Christian values and devitalized Oriental aesthetics were transfigured by the Aryan spirit and mentality into a religion more suitable for the Aryan psyche and more compatible to the Aryan mentality, where the passive and helpless anti-heroes they called martyrs were transformed into combatant, noble knights and polemic celestial avengers, like the figure of Saint George, the Dragon Slayer. But these two forces, these two tendencies within Christian religion, Catholic, Orthodox or other, are not yet settled, and frictions, divisions and strives are still raging. And the great question that arises is, to what extent is it possible to actually Aryanize Christianity in order to neutralize its nature as a perpetual infiltrator of foreign values and ideas in the mindset of our people? To what extent can Christianity become a genuine Aryan faith and worldview? Now, this is a very current and prevailing question that is debated a lot in many traditionalist and right-wing intellectual and political circles. My personal view is that it is not possible, no matter how one stretches it. Aryan spirituality and mindset needs its own expression that can be coded into a religion as well, a religion that must grow naturally and organically from within the folk's soul. But why do you think, Tyrus, it is important for you to actually practice this tradition and not just study it and understand it, which is much more common nowadays for those who explore the ancient traditions?
Well, many in the modern day have a tendency to call themselves pagans without actually having engaged in any rites, rituals, offerings, or even proper prayers given in the correct manner. And in many cases, people don't even really know where to start. This is effectively not returning to any kind of tradition, but just acknowledging its existence. While in the case of the Nordic people, somewhat uniquely amongst the Indo-European world, there was no dedicated priestly class that we have evidence for, at least. But there were still rites and rituals performed by educated and initiated members of the community that the community itself benefited from and was expected to partake in. This was an active part of their daily lives, often at the forefront of what they were doing, and thus the re-establishment of not just the active practice, but the mindset that active practice gives is integral for us to reconnect with our ancestors and our gods. Due to the modern man being severed from his gods and his ancestors, he has no idea of the importance of practicing religious tradition. As a result, many get tired of paganism and believe that it's not a true religion, which then sends them on to Christianity, which is more commonly actively practiced and often more convenient to follow, with churches and Christian communities everywhere around the world. There's also less learning one has to do before you can start practicing, as everything is generally overseen by some authority who already knows far more than you. Whereas even for those in priestly roles, as myself, paganism is a continuous path of learning and discovery. But in this way, you could say that our paths mirror the myths of gods and heroes, though perhaps not with the same dramatic effect. After all, many of the Nordic myths talk of Odin learning the runes and the secrets of the universe. Is this because the Norse god of wisdom, learning and journeying did not already understand the runes? Was this some historical event in which a man-shaped god went around learning things? No, of course not. The myths of these journeys of learning are there so that we might walk alongside the gods and learn these secrets for ourselves when we read or listen to the myths being recounted. Therefore, to embark on this journey to find knowledge is to emulate the gods and become closer to them. We also hear that there are even temples in Asgard in which the gods make offerings of their own. Is this because the Norse gods have gods of their own? Unless we're to believe the idea that the Norse gods were in fact Trojans, and these temples are therefore to the Greco-Roman gods, then there must be something else to it. These temples are said to be in Asgard in order to demonstrate the point that building temples and making offerings to the gods is not just honouring them, but emulating them, growing closer to them. And the act is integral to one's spiritual journey. Many people now believe that being a pagan is as simple as acknowledging the gods, often only as mere metaphors and possibly reading some mythology, and taking it no further than that. This isn't always done out of some kind of laziness, but rather people nowadays don't often realise that there is more to it than that. The men of old were true believers in the gods and didn't see them as just metaphors like many do now. However, those that hold this opinion generally take paganism as something exclusively belonging to mythology and the study of it, and have never made a proper offering in accordance with traditions of old. Something that is active and living. Something more akin to fables, in their case, than the esoteric and secret workings of the world and of man, to be practiced and studied alongside the sincere and active practice of the religion. The Roman priest, Mucius Scaevola, defined the religion of the Romans as being divided into three parts that complement and complete one another: the mythic, the physical, and the civil. The mythic theology is that used by poets and writers, that of the Iliad and the Aeneid, of the Eddas, the poetic and theatrical myths that typically also contained some esoteric elements. Think Prometheus Bound, for example. The physical theology is that of the scientists of old, many of whom were still called philosophers in their lifetimes. Aristotle would fall into this category, as would any others who wish to understand the workings of the natural world and how it functions according to the will of the gods. The civil theology is that concerning the nation and its people, the religion of the state or the tribe, overseen by the priests and the ruling caste, consulted in all matters of politics, warfare, and the everyday life of the people. This is the active practice of the religion, the offerings and prayers and sacrifices to the gods, the reading of omens, and the taking of auguries. These were all considered matters belonging to the civil domain. The Romans, like the Nordics and Germanics with their assembly of the thing, did not have a politicized religion, but rather politics was seen as one of the domains of religion. Jupiter, the Indo-European sky father, was seen as the eternal and divine head of state. And this isn't speculation on my part, this is essentially straight from the mouth of Scaevola himself, along with other Roman priests and theologians. With this explanation, straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak, I feel it's best to put to bed these ideas of our ancestors being fools who worship metaphors, as the theology of the natural world was clearly understood as being distinct from the active worship that a people practiced as a tribe or a state, and the natural world, rather than being the gods themselves, is instead ruled over by the gods, and different parts of nature are sacred to different deities. As the Roman philosopher Sallust tells us in his book On the Gods and the World, which you can listen to on our channel, lastly, fables are material, such as the Egyptians ignorantly employ, considering and calling corporeal nature's divinities, such as Isis Earth, Osiris Humidity, Typhon Heat, or again denominating Saturn Water, Adonis Fruits, and Bacchus Wine. And indeed, to assert that these things are dedicated to the gods in the same manner as herbs, stones, and animals is the part of wise men, but to call them gods is alone the province of madmen. And ultimately, what is the reason not to practice a traditional Indo-European religion? The reasons are usually because one thinks themselves beyond such things, deeming the offerings and prayers childish or foolish, and believing oneself above such things. But this is the same attitude with which the leftist sneers at the nationalist, believing himself superior and better educated, merely because he is ignorant even of his own ignorance. We see religious practice, both organized and personal, as something that is holding us back, and yet we have accomplished far less and lost so much more than our ancestors, dealing with what was apparently a setback and a superstition that we have done away with. Those who hate us and want us gone are doing an excellent job, and that cannot be denied. And these are people with a strong attachment to their heritage, their ethnic identity, and their religion, the two typically going hand in hand. those same things we have been severed from, often rather shamefully by our own choice. Our blood, our history, our gods, and even our natural worldview have all been kept strong in those who cheer on our declining societies and demographics. Is this coincidence? And in terms of purely secular and logical reasoning, then there are still many arguments to be made in favour of practicing organised European traditional religions, the first and foremost being that even if it is all just nonsense, as some claim, it's nonsense that inspired your ancestors to achieve great things, to go out and conquer, to do battle, to build nations and empires, and without it we would have collapsed. Clearly, there must be something to this so-called nonsense, after all. Secondly, a sense of structure and identity come hand in hand with the practice of religion. This is just an observable fact. If a group feels connected by blood, then connecting them by spirit and soul only brings them closer, without diminishing the connection of blood or providing a conflict of interest that comes with the universalist Abrahamic religions. The blood that is shared between kinsmen is a spirit in and of itself, a soul of the collective tribe, and the veneration of this spirit is of great importance. In our last episode, we spoke of Mars Teutates, Mars of the tribe, who was venerated by Romans, Celts, and Germanics alike. There is a fundamental unity between blood and spirit, and modern ideas and worldviews given to Europeans demand us to relinquish our connection with at least one of the two, if not both.
That was a very thorough and detailed answer, Tyrus, thank you. What is your view on the relation, if any, between paganism and politics? Can the political and the cultural struggle of today benefit from the revival of the ancient religions?
Well, as I said before, to our ancestors, politics wasn't separate from religion, be that in the Roman Senate or the Germanic and Nordic Thing, or Ting as it's also pronounced. Religion was a part of all things, and it was thought that the gods would help in the running of the tribe or the nation, and in many cases the leader of a tribe or people would claim divine ancestry as giving them their right to rule. In the eyes of many Indo-European people, the gods took direct interest in the running of the state, not being seen as some distant, unknowable beings that one only gets to see and truly experience after death, but rather as rulers and kings, protectors and divine ancestors. I personally believe that any political movement which wishes to bring about real change must first address the issue that has led to so many political problems in the first place, our severance from the divine. If we are to have states and empires, even simply functioning nations, then it is imperative that religiosity and a sense of the divine, of the higher purpose of life, be brought back into something that has become profane and worldly. Removing the gods from politics was a regression, a Masonic regression, not progress. And we can see that in how often mundane politics have become. Modern politics, at least in the mainstream, have become a joke, and it isn't exactly anything new for me to point that out. Successful politics in the past have always had a sense of the divine about them, a higher purpose that transcends economic policies and issues of immigration. That is not to say that we should simply sit around and pray and wait for the gods to sort things out on their own. That is quite contrary to the spirit of our people. But equally, if we are missing that connection with the gods, and our political systems focus only on profane and lower things, then whatever we build on a foundation of sand.
Yeah, exactly. From your personal experience, what are the potential risks and hazards in attempting to restore the ancient traditional Aryan religions?
Well, I'm glad you've asked that, because it's often not so straightforward and people can easily get things wrong and fall into these, well, pitfalls. but the biggest risk as it currently stands is the idea of universalism. People applying misinformed and modern standards to the practice of ancient religion. The application of this Abrahamic universalism to ancient religion is disastrous and is, I feel, a last-ditch attempt to prevent us from returning to our natural religions and worldviews by subverting our native religions with foreign ideas just as they begin to truly resurge. These Wiccans and so-called witches are not religious people at all, but rather a fan club, seeing paganism in the same light as their favourite book or TV show. They are completely absorbed by consumer culture and have no concept of the sacred. They only know meaningless interchangeability and think that everything that exists is their own product with which they can do whatever they like. Fans of the Vikings TV show now consider themselves pagans, as do Lord of the Rings fans, etc., etc. These people have absolutely no concept of anything sacred or eternal, and yet they think that they can just pervert ancient religion to suit their own modern worldview and modern political agenda. These also tend to be the same people we get accusing us of doing the same, without a hint of irony or self-awareness. We are actively making offerings to the gods, not writing baseless essays on how Achilles must have been a degenerate homosexual simply because he had a very close friendship with his comrade, the kind of brotherly bond of warriors and comrades that these people will never be able to understand or comprehend. Their entire identities are, after all, based on their made-up sexuality, and so they project this warped, over-sexualized view of the world onto ancient religion and mythology. I don't have to infer or corrupt the meaning of ancient works to find opinions and worldviews that match my own, but merely open the works of Tacitus, or in some cases even Cicero, to find worldviews and opinions that match my own. So, to summarize, I would say that the greatest potential risks are that we allow modern and alien views to taint and corrupt our reconstructions, which would bring about only a superficial paganism, devoid of the ties of blood and spirit that keep us bound together as erios, as kinsmen, and keeps us connected to the gods.
What about Roman paganism, the tradition you follow personally? Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Well, the tradition that I personally follow is possibly most well known as Religio Romanum, Roman religion, but there are many names that the tradition is known by. Cultus Deorum is another commonly used term, but the most simple and accurate English term is simply Roman tradition. This is the worship of the gods in the ways used by the ancient Romans during the Golden Ages, before the introduction of foreign mystery cults. Though even these mystery cults, such as that of Sol Invictus or Mithras, were still fundamentally Indo-European in character, focused on light and solar worship with a cyclical worldview, rather than the linear one presented to us by the Abrahamics. We don't see the gods as mere metaphors or personifications of natural phenomena, but we equally don't see them as just magic men in the sky throwing lightning bolts at anything that displeases them. In fact, the Romans, as with many other Indo-European peoples from the ancient Germanics to the Persians, outright forbade the depiction of the gods in the likeness of men or beasts, and this idea of the gods personified in human form, be that in statues or in general artwork, didn't really appear until the Romans began to adopt Greek culture and artwork. Plutarch, the Greco-Roman historian, in his work The Life of Numa, the second king of Rome, tells us, "Numa forbade the Romans to revere an image of the gods which had the form of man or beast, nor was there among them in this earlier time any painted or carved likenesses of deities, but while for the first 170 years they were continually building temples and establishing sacred shrines, they made no statues in bodily form for them, convinced that it was impious to liken higher things to lower, and that it was impossible to comprehend the gods except by the intellect.
Yes, very well. The non-depiction of gods was also an early Hellenic custom that survived to some extent into the classical era. All the great philosophers, with Plato and Heraclitus first, scorned and warned against superstitious iconography and generally the idolization of objects depicting the gods. It is, however, in the Germanic tribes where it was an ancient and well-established tradition, reflecting the idiosyncrasy and the peculiarity of the Germanic people. The spirit and idea of simplicity and purity, the avoidance of material depictions, statues, icons, etc., of divinities, manifested itself in Germanic Christianity as well. So the Protestant churches are famous for their simple and unadorned style, with scarce decorations and minimal icons and other symbols. And the whole Protestant movement was a revolt of the Germanic soul against the sound European Catholic Christianity, with roots and reasons much deeper than political, religious, and geostrategic independence. A similar phenomenon and analogy can we see in the Far East, where one tradition, Aryan in its origin, that of Buddhism, is interpreted and practiced so vastly different between different nations. Zen Buddhism, mostly common in Japan, is simple, minimalistic, both in context and aesthetics, where complicated verbalities in the scripts, intricate rituals and symbolisms are avoided because they are seen as distractions that obstruct and divert from the direct inner experience of the Absolute. And that in contrast, for example, to a Tibetan Buddhism, formed according to the Central Asian perception and superstition, overwhelmed in pictures and symbols, with huge amounts of holy scripts, literature, icons, and practices which aim towards the same goal. And these two vastly different conceptions and practices of an originally common tradition can only be explained by a racial perspective, proving once more the decisive importance of race in understanding the world.
Yes, this avoidance of humanistic depictions of the gods tends to fall in line very well with other Indo-European peoples and their traditions, as very few Indo-European peoples humanized their gods before contact with Greek culture, whether through the Greeks themselves or through the Hellenophilic Romans. The Germanics refused to depict the gods in human form in many cases, according to Tacitus, and even the Danes and Norwegians didn't really personify the gods before they began to join the Roman army as auxiliaries. Conventional thought puts this to the idea of animism, these apparently simplistic peoples being little more than simple nature worshippers. However, if the reasoning of Numa, as described by Plutarch, is truly the case, then there may have been a more philosophical and theological underpinning to this lack of humanistic depictions of the gods in non-Greek Indo-European cultures. Notice also how the Romans came to this decision. It was not through fear and superstition, as in Abrahamic religions that forbid images of their gods and prophets, calling it idolatry and threatening those who depict their god in artwork with death, but rather it was a decision based on wisdom and rational thinking, under instruction from a pious philosopher king who wanted his people to better understand the gods. Of course, Plutarch may have been writing anachronistically, and as a Greek under Roman rule, he takes special care throughout his work to give the Greeks as much credit as possible for Rome, even going as far as to call the Sabines, another Latin tribe, Spartan colonists living in central Italy. This legend seems rather fanciful, however, given that the Sabines spoke an Umbrian language, an Italic Indo-European language, rather than the Dorian dialect of ancient Greek spoken by the Spartans. In his work concerning King Numa, thought to have been born in 753 BC when Rome was founded, he says that he was a personal friend of the Greek philosopher and mathematician Pythagoras, born in 570 BC, and that Roman values were therefore based on Greek philosophy from the beginning. He then speculates as to whether it's the same Pythagoras or someone else by the same name, but remains quite convinced that Numa was a student of Greek philosophy, and an ethnic Spartan to boot. It's worth noting that these ideas of a Greek origin of the Roman people only came about long after Greek culture had already become very prominent and extremely influential in Rome, much to the disgust of many traditionalist Romans, from Cato the Elder to the satirical poet Juvenal. Prior to this, the Romans ascribed their origins to the Trojans, sworn enemies of the Greeks, and the Greeks regarded the Romans as a barbarian people for quite some time. Even as late as the Byzantine Empire, there were records of the Byzantines calling those in Rome and the West barbaroi, which has historically carried the dual meaning of both uncivilized savage and non-Greek.
Now, I would like to speak a little bit more about Cato the Elder. She's actually a very interesting personality. She lived between the 3rd and 2nd century BC, and I think he's a key personality regarding the Romans and all the Arian people. And however controversial he is, I think he played a key role in history. His fury and fierce opposition against Romans adopting Greek customs have to do with the deteriorating and orientalized Greek custom of his times, the Hellenistic times, the times after the great Hellenic expansion to the east, which was an era of decadence compared to the classical era and before, which was dominated by the strict and austere Doric spirit, best manifested in Sparta. At that time, Rome was establishing itself as a rising force of pure and polemic, uncompromising and authentic Roman Arian spirit, and saw the Hellenistic culture as weak and decadent, and admired and adopted only the classical Dorian spirit of Greece. The pure young Romans, though victorious in the Carthage Wars, dominated the Greeks, as similarly the German invasion of Rome from the tribes of Central Europe would dominate and revitalize the Italian peninsula some centuries later. Thus, Cato seems to be a symbol of authenticity and proximity to the original Arian spirit during the birth of a vigorous mighty nation, and a Cato, one who warns for the dangers of forgetting the ancient traditions, appears in all people. One who is always orientated towards the ancestral customs and virtues and despises wealth and weakness. In the same manner, Plato again decided to take his struggle against the Sophists, who intellectually distorted and twisted true philosophy into superficial logical conceptions for money. And the Sophists thus distorted the old customs. Aristophanes as well, the famous poet and composer of comedies, did very much the same thing, like Cato and Plato, though differently. He criticized, blasted and mocked the Athenians, who were becoming more interested in luxury, wealth and comfort, rather than virtue and philosophy, and thus distanced themselves from the ancestral spirit and traditions.
Well, with figures like Cato being so opposed to Greek culture, and many Romans after him too, I believe it should be fairly obvious that Roman culture was an Indo-European one with a lot of Greek influence, rather than the commonly held assumption that the Romans just copied everything the Greeks did and had no culture or religion of their own. It's worth saying that these connections and rivalries, but there is obviously a fundamental similarity between the Greeks and the Romans of these eras. It's better to say that the Romans considered the Greeks brothers or cousins rather than their fathers and ancestors. So these writings of these philosophers scorning one another or praising one another or taking credit for one another's civilizations and philosophies, I think this is a rationalization of the obvious similarities between these Indo-European peoples. Before the Proto-Indo-Europeans, their culture and their language was a known fact. Returning to the active practice of Roman religion, offerings are made chiefly at temples that have been built for the purpose of worship. This worship is not like that of the Christian churches in which men gather to sing songs and listen to readings from books, but rather it's the performance of an offering to either request something or to give thanks for something already received. And it's not actually performed inside the temple, but outside the temple in sacred ground. Alongside this, there are offerings performed by a priestly class rather than typical worshippers. In the times of Rome, these would be festivals and celebrations in honour of the gods and would often be performed for the success of the state, whether in politics or warfare. Of course, we no longer have a unified Roman state, so these offerings are typically performed with the success of the temple and the religion itself in mind. As for why the Roman tradition rather than the Anglo-Saxon or the Norse, the fundamental reason is that I was most drawn to the Roman, but of course there are also many secular reasons for it. I've had a multitude of vivid spiritual experiences in the past that have ultimately led me to the uniquely Roman path of Indo-European paganism. But I don't want to divulge into these. These are ultimately not relevant to the personal journeys of our listeners, and sharing such intimate experiences so openly and widely tends to completely devalue them. It's also often best not to rely on vivid spiritual visions for belief in the gods, as one can quite quickly find yourself becoming overly superstitious rather than working through the spiritual reasoning that is so characteristic amongst the great thinkers of our collective people. If we begin relying only on self-proclaimed prophets and the mystical visions of anyone who shouts the loudest about their so-called piety, then we risk mirroring the Abrahamic faiths that we are now having to break away from. And sticking to this policy of reason, I'll explain why I personally practice the Roman tradition. It's not born out of some obsession with classical architecture, or the fact that I think that their armour looks impressive, or even from an admiration of Roman political power and symbolism, which has, of course, been admired by many of the greats of our people for millennia. But rather, the religion of the Romans preserved the Indo-European faith incredibly well for the most part, and while eventually succumbing to foreign influence, there are still enough clear records on how the Roman religion was practiced, thereby making it the easiest to sincerely rebuild and involving the least guesswork.
That is actually very interesting, Tyrus. As I said, modern paganism is an attempt to recreate a religion that was practiced hundreds, even thousands of years ago. One of many problems in this endeavor is the lack of practical information and accurate records about the details, the rituals, the ceremonies, the processions, and so on. So for some traditions, like the Roman and the Hellenic, some records have survived. For others, like the Nordic, the Celtic, and the Slavic, much less can be found in the sources. But all these different traditional faiths of the European Aryans were similar in their essence, their fundamental ideas, and their worldview. They grew from the same center. And even historically, many parts of one European religious tradition were adopted and assimilated by another, smoothly, without conflict, and without altering the inner meaning or the national character of those traditions. My point is that we have often seen in the course of European history that the boundaries of national identities, that is language, customs, traditions, religion, and blood, are not solid. They change, they overlap. And this historical flexibility within the European folks that gave and still gives flexible, dynamic national compositions can be used in our advantage in order to put together a new European paganism. Loans and even appropriations of religious elements within the family of European traditions is not necessarily an unlawful amalgamation that undermines authenticity and purity. And when the need of spiritual expression in the free Europe of the future that will rise from the ashes of modernity will bring forth a new religion, it will most probably be a composition from different European traditions as perceived and interpreted by the Europeans of those specific future times.
I can understand why that might sound strange to a lot of Europeans who want to follow their ancestral traditions to the letter. It's important to remember that all of these European faiths came from a single root. Many now fill in the gaps of active practice and lost knowledge with Christian-style worship and prayer, and this is a very bad idea. It would be far better to take elements from other Indo-European traditions that preserved the worldview of your ancestors, the dominating warrior and aristocratic spirit, who honoured the same gods under different names. In terms of the authentically Indo-European character of the Roman religion, which many people see as being something foreign to the north. In the oldest preserved form of Roman religion, we find two triads of gods, one now known as the Archaic Triad, the other as the Plebeian Triad. The plebeians or plebs were the underclasses of Rome, thought in Roman legend to have been descended from the natives who lived amongst the lands already, whereas the patricians, the founding aristocracy of Rome, claimed illustrious, often divine heritage, such as that of Julius Caesar, claiming to be a direct descendant of the goddess Venus herself, through the Trojan hero Aeneas. Contrary to popular belief and modern Hollywood depictions, patricians were all expected to serve in the Roman army, whereas plebeians were explicitly forbidden until the very late Republican era, as it was thought that these plebs had no investment in the state and therefore could not be trusted to defend it. This was a fiercely nationalistic, militaristic, devotedly religious aristocracy.
That point is also very important, Iris, and I really hope our listeners didn't miss it. Now, contrary to the financial plutocracy of our times, the traditional Aryan aristocracy, all the way from the ancient times into the medieval times and later, was the guardian of the state, waging the wars and bleeding on the battlefields. And the benefits they enjoyed, being the upper ruling caste, came together with duties and obligations of a much higher and demanding level than the lower castes. In the traditional Aryan civilizations, the upper caste, the Omi in Sparta, the patricians of Rome, or the knights of the medieval times, and many more, they led a life not only of honor and privileges, but of austerity, harshness, and great danger, as it was their duty to defend the state and take up all the responsibilities and assignments that required character and nobility, leaving not only everyday labor, but even the financial administration to the slaves, the weak, and the aliens.
The patricians, the higher caste, as you say, who embodied this sense of nobility, they chiefly worshipped the Archaic Triad above all of the other gods, and these three gods would retain the status of the highest gods, each of them having a high priest known as a flamen. These three gods are Jupiter, the god of gods, Mars, the god of war, and Quirinus, the god of the citizen. Within these three, we see that each is the patron god of a specific caste of Indo-Europeans. Jupiter, the god of the kingly and priestly caste, Mars of the warrior caste, and Quirinus of the civilian caste. As well as this, the god Vulcan, god of metallurgy, among other things, had all of his worship performed outside the city, reflecting the lifestyle of the smiths in Indo-European society, having to live away from all of the others, a trend also seen in Hephaestus in Greek mythology being cast out of Mount Olympus in order to live separately from the other gods. Compare these three gods to the plebeian triad of Ceres, the mother of agriculture, and the god and goddess Liber and Libera, deities of fertility, freedom, and wine. And one can see the ultimately uniquely Indo-European influence amongst the patrician class, the fathers of Rome and the ruling aristocracy, compared to the pre-Indo-European cult of the fertility goddess, practiced by the comparatively peaceful, somewhat egalitarian agricultural farmers that lived in Europe before the invasion of the Indo-Europeans. For a good deal of Rome's history, one had to be of patrician birth to be a priest of any kind, and even at its most degenerate and liberal times, at least those, while it still put on the veneer of being a pagan empire still practicing the Roman religion, the highest class of priests, the flamen, still had to be of patrician stock, with no exceptions. The fact that we know all of this is very important. The Romans wrote down a great many things concerning the practice of their religion, and this makes it very easy for us to reinsert ourselves authentically to this tradition, and it may well be the closest we can get to a sincere and active practice of the Indo-European religion in the modern day. It's not a matter of reconstructing something from the ground up, but rather reinserting ourselves into a tradition and a connection with the gods that has always existed, whether we have chosen to acknowledge it or not. So, I follow Roman tradition chiefly because it is the most well-preserved of the Indo-European religions, especially in terms of active practice, and because the Romans, at least before their later fall into often exaggerated degeneracy, preserved the Indo-European spirit of their religion very well, and incorporated the worship of the Aryan Sky Father into the running of their very state. Even politics, therefore, had a somewhat divine character to it. This is not unique to the Romans, but it was the best preserved and most potent, with Nordic and Germanic tribes and nations having little need for the complex politics employed by the Romans and the Senate. And I'm not ignorant or dismissive of Nordic or Anglo-Saxon or other Germanic traditions, and neither were the Romans. As we've spoken about in our previous episode, the Romans saw the Germanics, Nordics, and Celts worshipping the same gods, just according to different traditions. Traditions that were still openly maintained, practiced, and even often encouraged under Roman rule. This did not apply to all cultures' gods, however. The Egyptian gods, for example, are described in the Aeneid, the cornerstone of Roman foundational myth and epic poetry, as being in battle with the superior Roman gods, who crushed the Egyptians, their allies, and their gods. These outwardly very different Indo-European traditions were and are, in truth, very compatible with one another, as they all come from the same worldview and sprang forth from the same root. It's not the religions and traditions that are so different, but rather the superficial lifestyles of the worshippers. But in both cases, this is often only superficial. In character, these Indo-European traditions are fundamentally linked. Therefore, for me to practice Roman tradition as my preferred form of active practice in worshipping the gods isn't to, for me to forsake Anglo-Saxon or Nordic paganism, but rather it allows me to grow closer to the Indo-European spirit and meaning behind those traditions, even if I am wearing a toga and speaking in Latin.
Great. Thank you for your thoughts, Tyrus. And we will publish this episode as a script as well, so that our listeners can even read it in peace and quiet and reflect on some very important points you took up. For my part, it is of course very positive that often following and practicing paganism is a result of an awakening process, where the individual feels the calling of his forefathers and explores and embraces their traditions, their worldview, and their attitude in life, or at least tries to. where one finds meaning, an inner center, an inner bond that connects him with the timeless reality of the idea of folk and race, and an inner compass that guides him in life in a manner that is appropriate to him, according to his and his people's specific characters and peculiarities. I personally think that it is absolutely necessary that the Aryan spirit, this eternal, life-giving and racially defined essence, this unmovable central pillar of our people's character, should be externalized and coded into a new religious tradition, a tradition that will become the dominant faith of the free and resurrected Europe of the future, adapted, of course, to the specific national attributes of the different European peoples and inspired by our ancestors' pre-Christian religious traditions. My approach, however, to modern paganism as we see it now, and at least for the last 40 years all over the white world, varies from skepticism, distrust, and all the way to open hostility. I see some major problems which make me think that modern pagan movements, organizations and groups, in some cases, not only do not help to advance our cause, but unwillingly undermine it or even openly oppose it. We see and hear often an anti-Christian fanatism and rhetoric in pagan circles, but on the same time, many of the ceremonies and the arrangements seem to be a barren copy, an uninspired imitation of Judeo-Christian ceremonies and structures, only transplanted and performed into a lifeless so-called pagan scenery, and often with a fixation to reproduce the outer, superficial formalities rather than inner meaning, formalities like the clothes, the sandals, the statues, the objects. It seems to me that sometimes many pagans look like Christian monks who dropped the clergy cloth and put on the pagan mantle, but few other things are different. Generally, I see a ridiculous, superficial imitation of very bad taste of our ancestors' aesthetics, and often an attempt to put together a romantic picture of how things looked and were done in the old. And no matter how hard they try to recreate this scenery, the picture becomes absurd and laughable, leading to the degrading and trivialization of our ancestors' aesthetics. So many pagan followers, single or in groups, reenact ceremonies and processions and rituals, and honestly, in many cases, the result is comic, a caricature of that romantic idea they have of how things were done, an idea which they fail to recreate. A major problem of many pagan groups, not all of course, is that they deliberately, or perhaps due to ignorance, they discount, they overlook, or even deny the most fundamental elements of our ancestors' philosophy, mentality, ethics, and worldview. Elements that were integrated in and expressed by the religious traditions as well. They overlook, diminish, or deny the strictly anti-democratic and aristocratic character of our ancestors' worldview and civilizations. They diminish or deny the strictly racial character of our ancestors' religiosity. Spirituality and religion, both of our ancestors and in all traditional cultures, was an internal matter of the people, the folk, and the race, founded upon and bounded by blood and soil. They overlook and trivialize the patriarchal, warlike, and heroic character of our ancestor spirit. Now, all these characters of our ancestors' mentality, which we have been speaking about again and again in Aristogenesis, were integrated naturally and beyond any doubt into their religion and their religious practices. Many modern pagans choose to remove these elements in their silly interpretation because either they don't fit into their indoctrinated liberal views and ideas, or because they know if they would adopt these ideas, they would be directly placed on the spotlight by the system, with stigmatization, retaliation, witch hunt, and all the consequences of a modern political dissident. and many pagans do not want to be in this uncomfortable position. But by removing and ignoring these elements from their attempt to revive the old religions, they actually remove the most essential parts. And that is why this recreation of the ancient faiths becomes superficial, false, lifeless, and doomed to fail. Our ancestral spiritual traditions, or religions, we may call them. And by the way, all the traditional worldviews and religions all over the world, except the Abrahamic ones, they were racial and ethnic, a manifestation of the psychological constitution, the moral ground, and the spiritual idiosyncrasy, all combined of a specific people at a specific time. And so any attempt to revive the pagan traditions today can only be built upon the solid foundations of the folk and the race, excluding foreign customs, foreign mentalities, foreign ideologies, and foreign blood. Those traditions were not inclusive or universal. They were not practiced for the sake of a poorly defined and vague humanity. They did not seek to benefit all peoples and races. They were not peaceful. They praised war and polemics, not only in defending the people, but also in all of the adventures and all cases where war was simply necessary. So we understand that rebuilding these religious traditions, not in their authentic form, as it is impossible to fully recreate the spirit of those times, but in a manner inspired by the spirit of those times. So rebuilding these traditions in a time where all the above are stigmatized as false, evil, and anachronistic by people who were born, raised, and indoctrinated by the pacifist and humanistic dogmas of modernity is a practical impossibility, an intellectual paradox that cannot be done. And the only way such an attempt may have a chance to be successful is by resetting and rebuilding ourselves, by rediscovering and recognizing the ancestral spirit on all levels. And that is not easy. It takes much more than reciting ancient words, calling upon ancient gods, and performing ancient rituals. This resetting requires a complete disposal of all modern trends and intellectual poisons that have been inflicted upon us since our birth. It requires a profound and multi-level awakening that will primarily help us recenter ourselves, an awakening process similar to your times, exactly as you described it. Our ancestors, both after but especially before Christianity, were not secular. Their societies were not secular. There was no legal or moral distinction between the political and the religious authorities and lives. Those two sides were harmoniously integrated because they grew forth organically together. Because our ancestors, as we keep repeating in our podcast, could see the analogy and correlation between different aspects of the world, between the metaphysical reality, the physical world, the structure of a state, the religion itself, and the structure of personalities. And it is Plato who explains this analogy and correspondence between these realities in most details and depth. They knew that the world is ruled and controlled by certain fundamental eternal principles, and these principles manifest themselves equally in quality into the laws of nature, into politics, in our mentality and intellect, and in religion. One can choose to separate politics from religion, but the principles acting in these areas are the same. And this artificial separation has only one effect: to confuse and mislead us. Many think that secularism, the strict separation and division between politics on one hand and religion and spirituality on the other, is a modern concept originating in the years of the Renaissance. But this is not true. It is the application of the concept of secularism that began carefully at the times of European Renaissance. The seed of the idea comes actually from early Christianity and the teaching of Jesus. It all originates from the very famous phrase of Jesus according to the Gospel of Marcus: "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." It was a major argument the early Christians were using when they were denying the sacred authority of the Roman emperor, one of the most fundamental ideas in the backbone of Roman mentality, and one of the reasons they were persecuted. When for the first time God, the divine, becomes distant to the human affairs, like politics, and the reign of the king or the emperor is no more a divine affirmation, but a merely human political affair. Now, I know I have been quoting the Bible a lot in our last episode, but it is important. People underestimate its influence in our world today, and not only in strictly religious matters. And to those who have studied theology and think that I don't have any authority or credibility to interpret the Bible, I say this: when it comes to the saying of Jesus, it is only Jesus himself who can give a credible answer of what he really meant. And my interpretation is as valid as anyone's trying to make sense of these aphorisms and fragments. And luckily enough, we have had many centuries in between us, so we have had the opportunity to see how these messages were interpreted and practiced in history and nowadays. To summarize my point, the average character of the modern man is incompatible with the traditions of our ancestors, and the zeitgeist, the spirit of our times, is incompatible, even a direct antithesis to the spirit of the times of our ancestors. Recreating a religious European tradition is a process of personal and collective, racial and national awakening, a revolutionary act, an act that demands revolutionary personalities, a revolution of spirit, of intellect, and a political revolution as well, that will provide and secure the ground where this spiritual awakening will flourish into an established religion as well.
What I think we are currently living through now, and this fundamental requirement for traditionalist revolutionaries, an oxymoron at any other time in history, may well be part of the prophecy of Prometheus. This prophecy was given to Zeus, the Sky Father, in the Greek tragedy Prometheus Bound, of which we've spoken briefly before. Prometheus is the spirit of rebellion and revolution. And for many millennia, the Sky Father and his eagle have kept this revolutionary spirit restrained and dominated, held steadfast in its place by the rational strength and order of our ancestors. But Prometheus warns Zeus, the Sky Father, the true god of our people, "There shall come a time when you will have to release me from these chains, as even you shall one day need me." Prometheus is then set free from his binds by Hercules, or Heracles, the son of the Sky Father, who has mastered himself and continues on his journey of struggle.
Another problem with major modern paganism is the following. We know that all religions have a ceremonial, outer side, which varies a lot, and a mystical part, a secret, inner, esoteric teaching, which varies much less from religion to religion. And that part lies prior and above the practiced religion, a part that is preserved by the mystics of every tradition and which is handed down from generation to generation with initiation processes. In Christianity, we can say that this mystic part is preserved in some Christian orders of monks. In Islam, it is Sufism, for example. In Judaism, it can be the Kabbalah. In the Vedic and Buddhist traditions, the borders between the outer practice and the esoteric mystical teachings are diffuse and bleak, because there the esoteric part is very dominant and central. Now, in all these religions and traditions, this esoteric message has been preserved by the mystics. The chain has been unbroken, but not in the European traditions. That part is missing in modern Aryan paganism. The traditions were broken for a long time ago with the coming of Christianity, and they cannot be easily revived and brought back to life. The esoteric message of European traditions is still there, but it has to be decoded and deciphered from within our myths and the teachings of the ancient philosophers. So somehow this esoteric part must be re-established as the foundation and the source of modern paganism, and of our politics for that matter. Otherwise, the outer practice religion is doomed to be overtaken by formalization, superficiality, lack of core, and become vulnerable to subjective interpretation, alterations, and infiltrations of foreign elements. We need the mystics in the esoteric part, and as I said, the only Aryan traditions that have survived unbroken since the beginning lie now in the East, the Vedic and Buddhist traditions. And there we need to seek help and inspiration in order to rediscover the mystical esoteric center of a future European religious tradition. Many think, of course, that the Europeans fail to see the real meaning of the Eastern traditions, and they usually approach them with a New Age attitude, or that the mystics, the teachers, the gurus of the East are not white, and they are not interested, or they don't relate to our political struggle. And they have a good point. There are, however, exceptions. There are white teachers of the ancient Aryan Vedic traditions nowadays who not only understand the political dimension and can relate to our struggle for the survival and awakening of the European nations, but who also encourage it. One of them is a Vedic guru. His name is Sri Dharma Pravartaka Acharya, American of Spanish and Italian descent, who among his other great philosophical works about the Vedic traditions has written the excellent and groundbreaking book called The Dharma Manifesto, where he explains the importance of esoteric spiritual traditions as a guide and a source of inspiration for politics, how to build national communities, and actively encourages a political and all-level resistance and struggle against universalism, humanism, cultural Marxism, and all the enemies of national traditions in the postmodern West. In his manifesto, he explains how politics and building and administrating a state begins primarily in our esoteric traditions, very much like Plato explained 2,500 years ago. We come now to the crisis of the modern world and the dire threat hanging over the Western world, and specifically the white race, that is being overwhelmed, neutralized, undermined, and outbred. We found ourselves on the brink of biological extinction and a very critical moment of the history of the whole planet and all races. What is the meaning and where is the place for paganism in these dark times? Well, trying to answer this question, we bump once more into major problems regarding the modern pagan movements. As I said, in many cases, what leads people to paganism is a process of awakening. I cannot imagine that this religious and spiritual awakening of white men and women that brings them to the pagan religions and movements is not accompanied or not the result of a parallel awakening from the lies and illusions of the liberal, materialistic, anti-spiritual and multicultural tyranny of the New World Order. Anyone who discovers the religious and spiritual legacy of his ancestors should be able to see the threat that the modern world poses to these traditions, and the threat that the modern world poses to the people, the very blood that expresses and potentially carries these traditions within. The political, cultural, and racial problem cannot just be ignored. If it is, the awakening is incomplete and the individual is ignorant or too cowardly to acknowledge the terrible reality we live in and the heroic effort that has to be undertaken in order to reverse it. One cannot have the luxury today to be just a pagan. One needs to be a political dissident, an activist, a nationalist, a traditionalist, a race warrior, and then he may become a pagan as well. Then he can earn the right to call himself a pagan. As we have been saying in our podcast, our ancestors' traditional societies were strictly hierarchical, and the structure was in accordance to the structure of the world, the cosmos, in accordance to the laws of nature, and in accordance to the structure of the folkish soul and the human personality, racially determined, of course.
This is a point that very few modern scholars wish to address. Painting our ancestors as some kind of rootless cosmopolitans simply because they preferred their own tribe to other Indo-European tribes, as if an ancient German tribesman hating other Germanic tribes like the Anglo-Saxons and the Norsemen, as well as hating Celts and Romans, somehow makes him less racist than some are in the modern day, and not in fact more hyper-nationalistic than even the most radical racial purists on the right wing today. Celts would massacre even other Celtic tribes just for living on the other side of the river, let alone what they were doing in their battles against Romans and Germans. Does this make them the forebears of modern racial equality, or the complete opposite? And what of the Roman historian, Cassius Dio? He was living in some of the very darkest times of the Roman Empire, under the degenerate tyranny of the foreign Punics, a Semitic people from North Africa known as the Severan Dynasty. Degenerates of foreign blood who had attained Roman citizenship and then seized power by force, before giving citizenship to all free men in the empire and their descendants, something previously unheard of in the history of the world. At the time, only a tiny minority of people living in the empire actually qualified as citizens. Roman citizens were forbidden from marrying non-citizens, according to laws known as the Lex Julia, and actively financially punished by the state if they did not have at least 3 full-blooded Roman sons. But in this age of foreign rule and free citizenship, does Cassius Dio treat his fellow Roman citizen as an equal by birthright, seeing no difference in race, only culture, which the two of them shared? No, of course he doesn't. Cassius Dio mocks and derides the Severan Emperor Caracalla for having mixed blood, and says that he inherited the worst traits from the mixed races from which he descended. And Cicero had a few choice words about our non-shellfish-eating friends. And Tacitus even spoke of how the Germanic peoples were a pure and unmixed race, unique amongst the barbarian peoples, and how elements of their culture, such as their strict chastity, were deserving of the utmost praise. Dio also mentions how Caesar was horrified at the implication of being seen as a tyrant over Romans, as opposed to Gauls, Africans, or Egyptians, implying that these people were acceptable to subjugate, as opposed to Romans. Aristotle, as we have mentioned before, describes the Eastern people of Asia Minor as best suited to slavery. This is a sentiment echoed by the Dutch folk hero Julius Kivalis, when he said, "Let Syria, Asia Minor, and the East, habituated to despotism, submit to slavery. Freedom is a gift bestowed by nature even on the dumb animals. Courage is the peculiar excellence of man, and the gods help the braver side." Now, many historians believe that Tacitus probably made that quote up, as he had a habit of using historical generals to make his own political statements. But if that were the case, it shows a bias from Tacitus himself. Along with his fine works and often unbiased appraisals of Germanic peoples, we have in Tacitus a soldier, politician, and priest, as well as a damn fine historian, a militaristic, fiercely nationalistic aristocrat speaking out against the increasing moral degeneracy of his times, with a burning hatred of Christianity, of moral sickness and weakness, and an attitude of what would today be described as rabid anti-Semitism, and a magnificent work of history that espouses the Germanic people, their strict morality and their racial purity. We find all of this in one of the main sources of European history in general, and then we are told by so-called professors of classical studies that racism did not exist in the ancient world, and that Rome was some kind of multicultural, multiracial, cosmopolitan empire populated exclusively by sexual degenerates, the exact kind of society that they wish to shape for us in the future.
Our ancestors believed that the physical world, the world perceived by our senses was a reflection of the timeless metaphysical world, organized, supervised, and vitalized by eternal principles which are absolute and unconditional. Eternal, higher, immortal ideas and principles that were often seen or depicted as personified deities. So for our ancestors, the human condition and all its undertakings and adventure has their origin, their source, and is guided by these ideas and principles. We can say they are guided from above, they are sacred. And this is how we choose to use the word sacred, originating from and inspired and guided by the principles of the timeless metaphysical reality seen through the soul of our race. Sacred. So everything was sacred for our ancestors. Their architecture was sacred in accordance to these realities, according to constellations and the harmony of the skies. Their wars were sacred, regulated by omens and the divine will. Their arts were sacred, always depicting or implying the eternal and the harmonious. The structure of the societies was sacred, reflecting the structure of the universe and the laws of nature. And of course, the religion they practiced was in a way an effort to maintain the connection to this sacred reality and find balance and guidance from that sacred, eternal, and life-giving source. And this is a fundamental message conveyed by all the philosophical and mystic traditions. And this gives us a guideline and a pattern that we must apply in politics as well. Politics in the meaning of the art of governing the human affairs, if the politics are to be real and harmonized to these eternal laws. So first come the ideas that manifest by our efforts and understanding into politics. Politics without these ideas, without consideration of the higher and the eternal, is blind administration, overtaken and corrupted by the flaws of the human character. Administration of the Soviet type, where the goal is, in the best case, effectivity and functionality. For our politics, the ultimate goal is the fulfillment of the potentiality of the individual, the nation, and the race. That is true politics. But now, in our modern and lifeless, unholy world of modernity, where politics are definitely not sacred, there is a problem. And I'm talking of a problem within our ranks as well. We have seen, since the end of the Second World War, the different political movements, nationalists, national socialists, traditionalists, and others, who fight on the political arena on one hand, and on the other hand, the modern pagan revival movements of the ancient Aryan traditions. Both have been growing and still grow separately, and often with suspicion and hostility towards each other. And this varies with time. Sometimes the pagan movements will have absolutely nothing to do with the political movements, because the political movements and their members are seen as uncultivated foot soldiers. And sometimes the political movements, the activists and the champions of the white race, look down on the pagan movements with scorn and contempt, because they see that pagans choose to avoid the crucial political arena. There is always overlapping, and people who individually try to do both, but seldom any organization or movement actively and meaningfully embraces both parts, politics and Aryan traditions. So what can be done? There is no way that we can resist and defeat the currents, the institutions, and the dogmas of modernity which threaten the very existence of our race and the very existence of life on the planet, without radical, revolutionary political struggle. Struggle that requires determination, perseverance, self-sacrifice, consequences, and suffering. There is no other way to do a revolution. So this part, let's say the political activism by the dissidents who revolt and fearlessly engage the system and take all the consequences and retaliations, is not negotiable. It is absolutely essential. The pagan movements in the white world, most of them anyway, cannot do that, and they have no intention of doing that. One argument is that paganism will inspire the revolutionaries of the future, but only the revolutionaries themselves can carry out this struggle, nobody else. And there lies another problem with modern pagan movements. In many cases, they are competitive and antagonistic to the political movements because they attract awakened young men and women who could potentially become political soldiers and give strength and momentum to the political struggle. And when I say political, I mean it in a holistic, complete manner, political, cultural, intellectual, moral, a struggle on all levels. So very often, the movements, the organizations, and the communities that have the will and the strength to engage the system, they are drained from manpower who, for different reasons, choose the pagan movements instead. It is the political revolutionary movements who will grow and incorporate the spiritual and eventually the religious part as well. It is the political movements that will develop into an embryo of the future sacred state, where all parts of human life and human affairs are included, where all needs and realities of the human existence will be addressed, the social, the political, the spiritual, and the religious, of course. We must keep in mind, however, that spirituality and religiosity are not the same thing. The lack of a functioning and broadly accepted Aryan religious tradition nowadays does not necessarily hinder our political struggle, as long as the political struggle has the Aryan spirit as a compass and an inner foundation. And this spirit finds expression in our ideas, in our determination, in our morals, in our aesthetics, in our character, and in our communities. So discovering and incorporating the authentic Aryan spirit and mindset in the political struggle is much more important than the expression of the same spirit in a religious practice. And I'm speaking to you as a member of such a political movement, of a community. Yes, we may not have a distinctive pagan religion yet, but we have our holy days, the great solstice and equinoxes, and all our national anniversaries. We have our initiations, all the battlefields of our struggle, inner and outer, that lifts us upwards to the skies. We have our holy men, the great philosophers, the artists, and the heroes of the past and the present. We have our congregations, our communities, and our folkish festivals. We have our holy places, our white mountains and our deep forests. We have our ceremonies, our festivals, and our political manifestations, which we perform as religious processions. We have everything necessary to build a new religious tradition of our own. But most importantly, we have the right mentality to grant credibility and legitimacy to these traditions, because our mindset is synchronized to the aristocratic, racially bound, warlike, patriarchal, and heroic disposition and standpoint of our ancestors. And regarding the religious practice, I say that it is not the rituals and the ceremonies that make men holy, but it is men of honor and virtue who legitimize and sanctify all rituals and ceremonies.
There is an importance in both ways of practice, as both bring a higher purpose to what we do in everyday life, whether that's in general day-to-day life or in real politics that seek to go beyond mere policies and bureaucratic paper-pushing and link our connection with the soul of our people and our connections to the divine, to the state itself. That is, the expression of the will of the people, guided and nurtured by a strong aristocracy of determined nobles in the truest sense. There is a great merit in reconnecting with the ancient practices of our Indo-European forefathers, in sincerity and authenticity, and linking it with an organically grown practice that is built as a safeguard against all the corruptions of modernity, still respectful to the traditions of our ancestors and the divine will of the gods. While, as you've rightly said, there is a great deal of information that we can gather from the unbroken Eastern traditions,
It often fosters a mindset that our only hope of reconnecting with the esoteric parts of our ancestral religion lies within the East, leading to white people shaving their heads and becoming Hindus. Whereas this is not what we're advocating. I personally believe that with proper practice and observance of our ancient traditions and the blessings of the gods, we will organically rediscover these elements of truth and wisdom that lie within our blood, our souls, and our connections to the gods. But equally, in these times in which such knowledge is scarce, we must seek the knowledge of ancestors anywhere that it has been preserved. And that about wraps it up for this episode. Once again, if you're listening on YouTube and would like to listen to the full episode, we haven't cut too much out, don't worry, but you'll be able to find it on our Spreaker channel, unless, of course, you listen to us on there already. We very much hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and we hope that our experiences provide some insight into our respective worldviews and ways of life. If you have any questions at all, whether about active practice of pagan religion, whether you want to know how to perform some offering to the gods, especially in the Roman Rite, or indeed anything else, the easiest way for you to reach me personally is over on the Aristogenesis Instagram account, aristogenesis.ig. We're also looking at getting a Telegram channel set up. I have to admit that I'm somewhat of a Luddite, an honorary boomer, if you will, so I'm just figuring out how it all works. I'd like to extend a special thanks and a shout out to a friend of ours over at the Pagan Bookshelf Telegram channel, who is giving readings of important books, some from our further reading lists. So if you like what we do, you should definitely check that out. For now, this has been Aristogenesis, Episode 5, Paganism in the Modern Day. Until next time.